Guardians, Red Fuel by Roy Dotrice. Haviland Tuff thought the Six Worlds Bio-Agricultural Exhibition a great disappointment. He had spent a long, wearying day on Brazilorn, trooping through the cavernous exhibition halls, pausing now and then to give a cursory inspection to a new grain hybrid or a genetically improved insect. Although the Ark's cell library held cloning material for literally millions of plant and animal species from an uncounted number of worlds, Haviland Tuff was, nonetheless, always alert for any opportunity to expand his stock in trade. But few of the displays on Brazilorn seemed especially promising, and as the hours passed, Tuff grew bored and uncomfortable in the jostling, indifferent crowds. People swarmed everywhere. Vagabond tunnel farmers in deep maroon furs, plumed and perfumed arenae landlords, somber nightsiders and brightly garbed evernoons from New Janus, and a plethora of the native Brazilian. All of them made excessive noise and favoured Tuff with curious stares as he passed among them. Some even brushed up against him, bringing a frown to his long face. Ultimately, seeking escape from the throngs, Tuff decided he was hungry. He pressed his way through the fairgoers with dignified distaste and emerged from the vaulting five-story Patolan exhibit hall. Outside, hundreds of vendors had set up booths between the great buildings. The man selling pop onion pies seemed least busy of those nearby, and Tuff determined that a pop onion pie was the very thing he craved.
"Sir," he said to the vendor, "I would have a pie."
The pieman was round and pink and wore a greasy apron. He opened his hot box, reached in with a gloved hand, and extracted a hot pie. When he pushed it across the counter at Tuff, he stared.
"Oh," he said, "you're a big one."
"Indeed, sir," said Haviland Tuff.
He picked up the pie and bit into it impassively.
"You're an off-worlder," the pieman observed. "Not from no place nearby, neither."
Tuff finished his pie in three neat bites and cleaned his greasy fingers on a napkin.
"You belabor the obvious, sir," he said.
He held up a long, callous finger.
"Another," he said.
Rebuffed, the vendor fetched out another pie without further observations, letting Tuff eat in relative peace. As he savored the flaky crust and tartness within, Tuff studied the milling fairgoers, the rows of vendors' booths, and the five great halls that loomed over the landscape. When he had done eating, he turned back to the pieman, his face as blank as ever.
"Sir, if you will, a question."
"What's that?"
the other said gruffly.
"I see five exhibition halls," said Haviland Tuff. "I have visited each in turn."
He pointed.
"Brazilorn, Vale Arene, New Janus, Vagabond, and here, Patola."
Tuff folded his hands together neatly atop his bulging stomach.
"Five, sir. Five halls, five worlds. No doubt, being a stranger as I am unfamiliar with some subtle point of local usage. Yet I am perplexed. In those regions where I have heretofore travelled, a gathering calling itself the Six Worlds Bio-Agricultural Exhibition might be expected to include exhibits from six worlds. Plainly, that is not the case here. Perhaps you might enlighten me as to why."
"No one came from Namor."
"Indeed," said Haviland Tuff.
"On account of the troubles,"
the vendor said.
"All is made clear," said Tuff. "Or if not all, at least a portion. Perhaps you would care to serve me another pie and explain to me the nature of these troubles." "I am nothing if not curious, sir. It is my great vice, I fear."
The pieman slipped on the glove again and opened the hot box.
"You know what they say, curiosity makes you hungry."
"Indeed," said Tuff. "I must admit I have never heard them say that before."
The man frowned.
"No, I got it wrong. Hunger makes you curious. That's what it is. Don't matter. My pies will fill you up."
"Ah," said Tuff.
He took up the pie.
Please proceed."
So the pie seller told him, at great rambling length, about the troubles on the world Namor.
"So you can see," he finally concluded, "why they didn't come. With all this going on, not much to exhibit."
"Of course," said Heavlin Tuff, dabbing his lips. "Sea monsters can be most vexing."
Namor was a dark green world, moonless and solitary, banded by wispy golden clouds. The Ark shuddered out of drive and settled ponderously into orbit around it. In the long, narrow communications room, Heavlin Tuff moved from seat to seat, studying the planet on a dozen of the room's 100 viewscreens. Three small grey kittens kept him company, bounding across the consoles, pausing only to slap at each other. Tuff paid them no mind. A water world, Namor had only one landmass decently large enough to be seen from orbit, and that none too large. But magnification revealed thousands of islands scattered in long, crescent-shaped archipelagos across the deep green seas, earthen jewels strewn throughout the oceans. Other screens showed the lights of dozens of cities and towns on the night side, and pulsing dots of energy outlay where settlements sat in sunlight. Tuff looked at it all and then seated himself, flicked on another console, and began to play a war game with a computer. A kitten bounded up into his lap and went to sleep. He was careful not to disturb it. Sometime later, a second kitten vaulted up and pounced on it, and they began to tussle. Tuff brushed them to the floor. It took longer than even Tuff had anticipated, but finally the challenge came, as he had known it would.
"Ship in orbit," came the demand. "Ship in orbit. This is Namor Control. State your name and business. State your name and business, please. Interceptors have been dispatched. State your name and business."
The transmission was coming from the chief landmass. The Ark tapped into it. At the same time, it found the ship that was moving toward them. There was only one, and flashed it on another screen.
"I am the Ark," Heavlin Tuff told Namor Control.
Namor Control was a round-faced woman with close-cropped brown hair, sitting at a console and wearing a deep green uniform with gold piping. She frowned, her eyes flicking to the side, no doubt to a superior or another console.
"Ark," she said, "state your home world, state your home world, and your business, please."
The other ship had open communications with the planet, the computer indicated. Two more view screens lit up. One showed a slender young woman with a large, crooked nose on a ship's bridge, the other an elderly man before a console. They both wore green uniforms and were conversing animatedly in code. It took the computer less than a minute to break it, so Tuff could listen in.
"Damned if I know what it is," the woman on the ship was saying. "There's never been a ship that big. My God, just look at it. Are you getting all this? Has it answered?"
"Ark," the round-faced woman was still saying, "state your home world and your business, please. This is Namor Control."
Heavlin Tuff cut into the other conversation to talk to all three of them simultaneously.
"This is the Ark," he said. "I have no home world, sirs. My intentions are purely peaceful, trade and consultation. I learned of your tragic difficulties, and moved by your plight, I have come to offer you my services."
The woman on the ship looked startled.
"What are you—"
she started. The man was equally nonplussed, but he said nothing, only gaped open-mouthed at Tuff's blank white visage.
"This is Namor Control, Ark," said the round-faced woman. "We are closed to trade. Repeat, we are closed to trade. We are under martial law here."
By then, the slender woman on the ship had composed herself.
"Ark, this is Guardian Kefira K, commanding NGS Sunraiser. We are armed, Ark. Explain yourself. You are 1,000 times larger than any trader I've ever seen. Ark, explain yourself or be fired upon."
"Indeed," said Heavlin Tuff. "Threats will avail you little, Guardian. I am most sorely vexed. I have come all this long way from Brazilorn to offer you my aid and solace.
and you meet me with threats and hostility."
A kitten leaped up into his lap. Tuff scooped it up with a huge white hand and deposited on the console in front of him, where the viewer would pick it up. He gazed down at it sorrowfully.
"There is no trust left in humanity," he said to the kitten.
"Hold your fire, Sunraiser," said the elderly man. "Ark, if your intentions are truly peaceful, explain yourself. What are you? We are hard-pressed here, Ark, and Namor is a small, undeveloped world. We have never seen your like before. Explain yourself."
Haviland Tuff stroked the kitten.
"Always I must truckle to suspicion," he told it. "They are fortunate that I am so kind-hearted, or else I would simply depart and leave them to their fate."
He looked up straight into the viewer.
"Sir," he said, "I am the Ark. I am Haviland Tuff, captain and master here, crew entire. You are troubled by great monsters from the depths of your seas, I have been told. Very well, I shall rid you of them."
Ark, this is Sunraiser. How do you propose doing that?
"The Ark is a seed ship of the Ecological Engineering Corps," said Haviland Tuff with stiff formality. "I am an ecological engineer and a specialist in biological warfare."
"Impossible," said the old man. "The EEC was wiped out 1,000 years ago, along with the Federal Empire. None of their seed ships remain."
"How distressing," said Haviland Tuff. "Here I sit in an illusion. No doubt now that you have told me my ship does not exist, I shall sink right through it and plunge into your atmosphere while I shall burn up as I fall."
"Guardian," said Kaphira Kay from the Sunraiser, "these seed ships may indeed no longer exist, but I am fast closing on something that my scopes tell me is almost 30 kilometers long. It does not appear to be an illusion."
"I am not yet fallen," admitted Haviland Tuff.
"Can you truly help us?" asked the round-faced woman at Namor Control.
"Why must I always be doubted?" Tuft asked the small grey kitten.
"Lord Guardian, we must give him the chance to prove what he says," insisted Namor Control. Tuff looked up.
"Threatened, insulted, and doubted as I have been, nonetheless my empathy for your situation bids me to persist. Perhaps I might suggest that Sunraiser dock with me, so to speak. Guardian Kay may come aboard and join me for an evening meal while we converse. Surely your suspicions cannot extend to mere conversation, that most civilized of human pastimes."
The three guardians conferred hurriedly with each other and with a person or persons off-screen, while Haviland Tuff sat back and toyed with a kitten.
"I shall name you Suspicion," he said to it, "to commemorate my reception here. Your sibling shall be Doubt, Hostility, Ingratitude, and Foolishness."
"We accept your proposal, Haviland Tuff," said Guardian Kaphira Kay from the bridge of the Sunraiser. "Prepared to be boarded."
"Indeed," said Tuff. "Do you like mushrooms?"
The shuttle deck of the Ark was as large as the landing field of a major starport and seemed almost a junkyard for derelict spacecraft. The Ark's own shuttles stood trim in their launch berths, five identical black ships with rakish lines and stubby triangular wings angling back, designed for atmospheric flight and still in good repair. Other craft were less impressive. A teardrop-shaped trading vessel from Avalon squatted wearily on three extended landing legs, next to a drive-shift courier scored by battle, and a Carileo lion boat whose ornate trim was largely gone. Elsewhere stood vessels of stranger, more alien design. Above, the great dome cracked into 100 pie-wedge segments and drew back to reveal a small yellow sun surrounded by stars, and a dull green manta-shaped ship of about the same size as one of Tuff's shuttles. The Sunraiser settled, and the dome closed behind it. When the stars had been blotted out again, atmosphere came swirling back into the deck, and Havlin Tuff arrived soon after. Kafira Kay emerged from her ship with her lips set sternly beneath her big, crooked nose, but no amount of control could quite conceal the awe in her eyes. Two armed men in golden coveralls trimmed with green followed her. Havlin Tuff drove up to them in an open three-wheeled cart.
"I am afraid that my dinner invitation was only for one, Guardian Kay," he said when he saw her escort. "I regret any misunderstanding, yet I must insist."
"Very well," she said. She turned to the guard. "Wait with the others. You have your orders." When she got in next to Tuff, she told him, "The Sunraiser will tear your ship apart if I am not returned safely within 2 standard hours. Havlin Tuff blinked at her.
"Dreadful," he said. "Everywhere my warmth and hospitality is met with mistrust and violence."
He set the vehicle into motion. They drove in silence through a maze of interconnected rooms and corridors and finally entered a huge, shadowy shaft that seemed to extend the full length of the ship in both directions. Transparent vats of 100 different sizes covered walls and ceiling as far as the eye could see. Most empty and dusty, a few filled with coloured liquids in which half-seen shapes stirred feebly. There was no sound, but a wet, viscous dripping somewhere off behind them. Kafira Kay studied everything and said nothing. They went at least 3 kilometres down the great shaft until Tuff veered off into a blank wall that dilated before them. Shortly thereafter, they parked and dismounted. A sumptuous meal had been laid out in the small Spartan dining chamber to which Tuff escorted the guardian Kafira Kay. They began with ice soup, sweet and piquant, and black as coal, followed by neo-grass salads with a gingery topping. The main course was a breaded mushroom top, full as large as the plate on which it was served, surrounded by 12 different sorts of vegetables in individual sauces. The guardian ate with great relish.
"It would appear you find my humble fare to your taste," observed Havlin Tuff.
"I haven't had a good meal in longer than I care to admit," replied Kafira Kay. "On Namor we have always depended on the sea for our sustenance. Normally it is bountiful, but since our troubles began—" She lifted a forkful of dark, misshapen vegetables in a yellow-brown sauce. "What am I eating? It's delightful."
"Rhenese sinner's root in a mustard sauce," Havlin Tuff said.
Kay swallowed and set down the fork.
"But Rhiannon is so far. How do you—" She stopped.
"Of course," Tuff said, steepening his fingers beneath his chin as he watched her face. "All this provender derives from the Ark, though originally it might be traced back to 12 different worlds. Would you like some more spiced milk?"
"No," she muttered. She gazed at the empty plates. "You weren't lying, then. You are what you claim, and this is a seed ship of the— what did you call them?"
"The Ecological Engineering Corps of the long-defunct Federal Empire. Their ships were few in number, and all but one destroyed by the vicissitudes of war. The Ark alone survived, derelict for a millennium. The details need not concern you. Suffice it to say that I found it and made it functional."
"You found it?"
"I believe I just said as much in those very same words. Kindly pay attention. I am not partial to repeating myself. Before finding the Ark, I made a humble living from trade. My former ship is still on the landing deck. Perhaps you chance to see it."
"Then you're really just a trader?"
"Please," said Tuff with indignation. "I am an ecological engineer. The Ark can remake whole planets, Guardian. True, I am but one man alone, when once this ship was crewed by 200, and I do lack the extensive formal training such as was given centuries ago to those who wore the golden theatre. the sigil of the ecological engineers, yet in my own small way I contrive to muddle through. If Namor would care to avail itself of my services, I have no doubt that I can help you.
Why? The slender guardian asked warily. Why are you so anxious to help us? Havlintuff spread his big white hands helplessly.
I know I may appear a fool. I cannot help myself. I am a humanitarian by nature, much moved by hardship and suffering. I could no more abandon your people, beset as they are, than I could arm one of my cats. The ecological engineers were made of sterner stuff, I fear, but I am helpless to change my sentimental nature. So here I sit before you, prepared to do my best.
You want nothing?
I shall labor without recompense, said Tuff. Of course I will have operating expenses. I must charge a small fee to offset them. Say 3 million standards. Do you think that fair?
Fair, she said sarcastically. Fairly high, I'd say. There have been others like you, Tuff. Arms merchants and soldiers of fortune who have come to grow rich off our misery.
Guardian, said Tuff reproachfully, you do me grievous wrong. I take little for myself. The ark is so large, so costly. Perhaps 2 million standards would suffice. I cannot believe you would grudge me this pittance. Is your world worth less?
Kefirike sighed, a tired look etched on her narrow face. No, she admitted. Not if you can do all you promise. Of course we are not a rich world. I will have to consult my superiors. This is not my decision alone. She stood up abruptly. Your communications facilities?
Through the door and left down the blue corridor, the fifth door on the right.
Tuff rose with ponderous dignity and began cleaning up as she left. When the guardian returned, he had opened a decanter of liquor, vividly scarlet, and was stroking a black-and-white cat who had made herself at home on the table. "You're hired, Tuff," said Kefirike, seating herself. 2 million standards after you win this war."
"Agreed," said Tuff. "Let us discuss your situation over glasses of this delightful beverage."
"Alcoholic?"
"Mildly narcotic."
"A guardian uses no stimulants or depressants. We are a fighting guild. Substances like that pollute the body and slow the reflexes. A guardian must be vigilant. We guard and protect."
"Laudable," said Havlintuff. He filled his own glass.
"Sunraiser is wasted here. It has been recalled by Namor Control. We need its combat capabilities below."
"I shall expedite his departure, then. And yourself?"
"I have been detached," she said, wrinkling up her face. "We are standing by with data on the situation below. I am to help brief you and act as your liaison officer." The water was calm, a tranquil green mirror from horizon to horizon. It was a hot day. Bright yellow sunlight poured down through a thin bank of gilded clouds. The ship rested still on the water, its metallic sides flashing silver-blue, its open deck a small island of activity in an ocean of peace. Men and women, small as insects, worked the dredges and nets bare-chested in the heat. A great claw full of mud and weeds emerged from the water, dripping, and was sluiced down an open hatchway. Elsewhere, bins of huge, milky jellyfish baked in the sun. Suddenly, there was agitation. For no apparent reason, people began to run. Others stopped what they were doing and looked around, confused. Still others worked on, oblivious. The great metal claw opened and emptied now, swung back out over the water, and submerged again, even as another one rose on the far side of the ship. More people were running. Two men collided and went down. Then the first tentacle came curling up from beneath the ship. It rose and rose. It was longer than the dredging claws. Where it emerged from the dark green sea,
It looked as thick as a big man's torso. It tapered to the size of an arm. The tentacle was white, a soft, slimy sort of white. All along its underside were vivid pink circles, big as dinner plates, circles that writhed and pulsed as the tentacle curled over and about the huge farming ship. The end of the tentacle split into a rat's nest of smaller tentacles, dark and restless as snakes. Up and up it went, and then over and down, pinioning the ship. Something moved on the other side, something pale stirring beneath all that green, and the second tentacle emerged. Then a third and a fourth. One wrestled with a dredging claw. Another had the remains of a net draped all about it, like a veil, which didn't seem to hinder it. Now all the people were running, all but those the tentacles had found. One of them had curled itself around a woman with an axe. She hacked at it wildly, thrashing in the pale embrace until her back arched, and suddenly she fell still. The tentacle dropped her, white fluid pulsing feebly from the gashes she had left, and seized someone else. 20 tentacles had attached themselves when the ship abruptly listed to starboard. Survivors slid across the deck and into the sea. The ship tilted more and more. Something was pushing it over, pulling it down. Water sloshed across the side and into the open hatchways. Then the ship began to break up. Havlentuff stopped the projection and held the image on the large viewscreen. The green sea and golden sun, the shattered vessel, the pale embracing tentacles. "This was the first attack?" he asked. "Yes and no," Kefira Kay replied. "Prior to this, one other harvester and two passenger hydrofoils had vanished mysteriously. We were investigating, but we did not know the cause. In this case, a news crew happened to be on the site, making a recording for an educational broadcast. They got more than they bargained for."
"Indeed," said Tuff.
"They were airborne in a skimmer. The broadcast that night almost caused a panic. But it was not until the next ship went down that things began to get truly serious. That was when the Guardians began to realize the full extent of the problem." Havlin Tuff stared up at the viewscreen, his heavy face impassive, expressionless, his hands resting on the console. A black-and-white kitten began to bat at his fingers.
"Away, foolishness," he said, depositing the kitten gently on the floor.
"Enlarge a section of one of the tentacles," suggested the Guardian beside him. Silently, Tuff did as she bid him. A second screen lit up, showing a grainy close-up of a great pale rope of tissue arching over the deck. "Take a good look at one of the suckers," said Kay. "The pink area's there, you see."
"The third one from the end is dark within, and it appears to have teeth."
"Yes," said Kefira Kay. "All of them do. The outer lips of those suckers are a kind of hard, fleshy flange. Slapped down, they spread and create a vacuum seal of sorts, virtually impossible to tear loose. But each of them is a mouth, too. Within the flange is a soft pink flap that falls back, and then the teeth come sliding out. A triple row of them, serrated and sharper than you'd think. Now move down to the tendrils at the end, if you would." Tuff touched the console and put another magnification up on a third screen, bringing the twisting snakes into easy view. "Eyes," said Kefira Kay. "At the end of every one of those tendrils, 20 eyes. The tentacles don't need to grope around blindly. They can see what they're doing."
"Fascinating," said Havlin Tuff. "What lies beneath the water? The source of these terrible arms?"
"There are cross-sections and photographs of dead specimens later on, as well as some computer simulations. Most of the specimens we took were quite badly mangled. The main body of the thing is a sort of an inverted cup, like a half-inflated bladder, surrounded by a great ring of bone and muscle that anchors these tentacles. The bladder fills and empties with water to enable the creature to rise to the surface or descend far below. The submarine principle. By itself, it doesn't weigh much, although it is amazingly strong.
What it does, it empties its bladder to rise to the surface, grabs hold, and then begins to fill again. The capacity of the bladder is astounding, and as you can see, the creature is huge. If need be, it can even force water up those tentacles and out of its mouths in order to flood the vessel and speed things along. So those tentacles are arms, mouths, eyes, and living hoses all at once.
And you say that your people had no knowledge of such creatures until this attack?
Right. A cousin of this thing, the Nemorian man-of-war, was well known in the early days of colonization. It was a sort of cross between a jellyfish and an octopus with 20 arms. Many native species are built along the same lines. A central bladder, or body, or shell, or what have you, with 20 legs or tendrils, or tentacles, in a ring around it. The men of war were carnivores, much like this monster, although they had a ring of eyes on the central body instead of at the end of the tentacles. The arms couldn't function as hoses either, and they were much smaller, about the size of a human. They bobbed about on the surface, above the continental shells, particularly above mud pot beds, where fish were thick. Fish were their usual prey, although a few unwary swimmers met a bloody, awful death in their embrace.
"Might I ask what became of them?" said Tuff.
"They were a nuisance. Their hunting grounds were the same areas we needed, shallows rich with fish and seagrass and waterfruit, over mudpot beds and scrabbler runs full of chameleon clams and bobbing freddies. Before we could harvest or farm safely, we had to pretty much clean out the men of war. We did. Oh, there are still a few around, but they are rare now."
"I see," said Haviland Tuff. "And this most formidable creature, this living submarine and ship-eater that plagues you so dreadfully, does it have a name?"
"The Nemorian Dreadnought," said Kavira Kay. "When it first appeared, we theorized it was an inhabitant of the great deeps that had somehow wandered to the surface. Namor has been inhabited for barely 100 standard years, after all. We have scarcely begun to explore the deeper regions of the seas, and we have little knowledge of the things that might live down there. But as more and more ships were attacked and sunk, it became obvious that we had an army of dreadnoughts to contend with."
"A navy," corrected Haviland Tuff.
Kefira Kay scowled. "Whatever. A lot of them, not one lost specimen. At that point, the theory was that some unimaginable catastrophe had taken place deep under the ocean, driving forth this entire species."
"You give no credit to this theory," Tuff said.
"No one does. It's been disproved. The dreadnoughts wouldn't be able to withstand the pressures at those depths. So now we don't know where they came from." She made a face. "Only that they are here."
"Indeed," said Haviland Tuff. "No doubt you fought back."
"Certainly. A game, but losing fight. Namor is a young planet, with neither the population nor the resources for the sort of struggle we have been plunged into. 3 million Nemorians are scattered across our seas on more than 17,000 small islands. Another million huddle on New Atlantis, our single small continent. Most of our people are fisherfolk and sea farmers. When all this began, the Guardians numbered barely 50,000. Our guild is descended from the crews of the ships who brought the colonists from old Poseidon and Aquarius here to Namor. We have always protected them. But before the coming of the dreadnoughts, our task was simple. Our world was peaceful, with little real conflict. There was some ethnic rivalry between Poseidonites and Aquarians, but it was good-natured. The Guardians provided planetary defense, with Sunraiser and two similar craft, but most of our work was in fire and flood control, disaster relief, police work, that sort of thing. We had about 100 armed hydrofoil patrol boats, and we used them for escort duty for a while, and inflicted some casualties, but they were really no match for the dreadnoughts. It soon became clear that there were more dreadnoughts than patrol boats anyway."
"Nor do patrol boats reproduce, as I must assume these dreadnoughts do," Tuff said.
Foolishness and doubt were tussling in his lap. Exactly. Still, we tried. We dropped depth charges on them when we detected them below the sea. We torpedoed them when they came to the surface. We killed hundreds. But there were hundreds more, and every boat we lost was irreplaceable. Namor has no technological base to speak of. In better days, we imported what we needed from Brazilorn and Vale Arene. Our people believed in a simple life. The planet couldn't support industry anyway. It is poor in heavy metals and has almost no fossil fuel.
How many Guardian patrol boats remain to you? Asked Havilan Tuff.
Perhaps 30. We dare not use them anymore. Within a year of the first attack, the dreadnoughts were in complete command of our sea lanes. All of the great harvesters were lost. Hundreds of sea farms had been abandoned or destroyed. Half of the small fisher folk were dead, and the other half huddled fearfully in port. Nothing human dared move on the seas of Namor.
Your islands were isolated from one another?
Not quite, Kefira Kay replied. The Guardians had 20 armed skimmers, and there were another 100-odd skimmers and air cars in private hands. We commandeered them, armed them. We also had our airships. Skimmers and air cars are difficult and expensive to maintain here. Parts are hard to come by, and we had few trained techs. So most of the air traffic before the Troubles was carried by airships, solar-powered, helium-filled, large. There was quite a sizable fleet, as many as 1,000. The airships took over the provisioning of some of the small islands where starvation was a very real threat. Other airships, as well as the Guardian skimmers, carried on the fight. We dumped chemicals, poisons, explosives and such from the safety of the air and destroyed thousands of dreadnoughts, although the cost was frightful. They clustered thickest about our best fishing grounds and mud pot beds, so we were forced to blow up and poison the very areas we needed most. Still, we had no choice. For a time, we thought we were winning the fight. A few fishing boats even put out and returned safely, with a Guardian skimmer flying escort.
Obviously, this was not the ultimate result of the conflict, said Havilan Tuff, or we would not be sitting here talking.
Doubt batted foolishness soundly across the head, and the smaller kitten fell off Tuff's knee to the floor. Tuff bent and scooped him up.
"Here," he said, handing him to Kefira Kay. "Hold him, if you please. Their small war is distracting me from your larger one."
"Why, of course." The Guardian took the small black-and-white kitten in hand gingerly. He fitted snugly into her palm. "What is it?" she asked.
"A cat," said Tuff. "He will jump out of your hand if you continue to hold him as if he were diseased fruit. Kindly put him in your lap. I assure you he is harmless."
Kefira Kay, appearing very uncertain, shook the kitten out of her hand onto her knees. Foolishness yowled, almost tumbling to the floor again, before sinking his small claws into the fabric of her uniform.
"Ow!" said Kefira Kay. "It has talons."
"Claws," corrected Tuff, "tiny and armless."
They aren't poisoned, are they?"
"Oh, I think not," said Tuff. "Stroke him, front to back. It will make him less agitated."
Kefira Kay touched the kitten's head uncertainly.
"Please," said Tuff. "I said stroke, not pat."
The Guardian began to pet the kitten. Instantly, foolishness began to purr. She stopped and looked up in horror.
It's trembling," she said, "and making a noise."
"Such a response is considered favorable," Tuff assured her. "I beg you to continue your ministrations and your briefing, if you will."
"Of course," said Kay. She resumed petting foolishness, who settled down comfortably on her knee. "If you would go on to the next tape," she prompted. Tuff wiped the stricken ship and the dreadnought off the main screen. Another scene took their place. A winter's day, windy and chill by the look of it. The water below was dark and choppy, flecked with white foam as the wind pushed against it. A dreadnought was afloat the unruly sea.
Its huge white tentacles extended all around it, giving it the look of some vast swollen flower bobbing on the waves. It reached up as they passed overhead, two arms with their writhing snakes lifting feebly from the water, but they were too far above to be in danger. They appeared to be in the gondola of some long silver airship, looking down through a glass-bottom viewport, and as Tuff watched, the vantage point shifted, and he saw that they were part of a convoy of three immense airships, cruising with stately indifference above the war-torn waters.
"The Spirit of Aquarius, the Lyle D, and the Sky Shadow," said Kaffira K, "on a relief mission to a small island grouping in the north where famine had been raging. They were going to evacuate the survivors and take them back to New Atlantis." Her voice was grim. "This record was made by a news crew on the Sky Shadow, the only airship to survive. Watch."
On and on the airship sailed, invincible and serene. Then, just ahead of the silver-blue Spirit of Aquarius, there was motion in the water. Something stirring beneath that dark green veil. Something big, but not a dreadnought. It was dark, not pale. The water grew black and blacker in a great swelling patch, then bulged upward. A great ebony dome heaved into view and grew like an island emerging from the depths, black and leathery and immense, and surrounded by 20 long black tentacles. Larger and higher it swelled, second by second, until it burst from the sea entirely. Its tentacles hung below it, dripping water as it rose. Then they began to lift and spread. The thing was fully as large as the airship moving toward it. When they met, it was as if two vast leviathans of the sky had come together to mate. The black immensity settled atop the long silver-blue dirigible, its arms curling about in a deadly embrace. They watched the airship's outer skin tear asunder, and the helium cells rip and crumple. The Spirit of Aquarius twisted and buckled like a living thing and shriveled in the black embrace of its lover. When it was over, the dark creature dropped the remains into the sea. Tuff froze the image, staring with solemn regard at the small figures leaping from the doomed gondola.
"Another one got the Lyle D on the way home," said Kaffira K. "The Sky Shadow survived to tell the story, but it never returned from its next mission. More than 100 airships and 12 skimmers were lost in the first week the fire balloons emerged."
"Fire balloons?" queried Havilland Tuff.
He stroked Doubt, who was sitting on his console.
"I saw no fire."
"The name was coined the first time we destroyed one of the accursed things. A Guardian skimmer put a run of explosive shot into it, and it went up like a bomb, then sank burning into the sea. They are extremely inflammable. One laser burst and they go up spectacularly."
"Hydrogen," said Havilland Tuff.
"Exactly," the Guardian confirmed. "We've never taken one whole, but we've puzzled them out from bits and pieces. The creatures can generate an electric current internally. They take on water and perform a sort of biological electrolysis. The oxygen is vented into the water or the air, and it helps push the things along. Air jets, so to speak. The hydrogen fills the balloon sacs and gives them lift. When they want to retreat to the water, they open a flap on top. See? Up there. And all the gas escapes, so the fire balloon drops back into the sea. The outer skin is leathery, very tough. They're slow but clever. At times they hide in cloud banks and snatch on wary skimmers flying below. And we soon discovered, to our dismay, that they breed just as fast as the dreadnoughts."
"Oh, most intriguing," said Havilland Tuff. "So I might venture to suggest, with the emergence of these fire balloons, you lost the sky as well as the sea."
"More or less," admitted Kaffira K. "Our airships were simply too slow to risk. We tried to keep things going by sending them out in convoys escorted by guardian skimmers and air cars, but even that failed. The morning of the far dawn, I was there, commanding a 9-gun skimmer. It was terrible.
Continue, said Tuff.
The far dawn, she muttered bleakly, we had 30 airships, 30. A great convoy protected by a dozen armed skimmers. A long trip from New Atlantis to the Broken Hand, a major island grouping. Near dawn on the second day, just as the east was turning red, the sea beneath us began to seethe, like a pot of soup that has begun to boil. It was them, venting oxygen and water, rising, thousands of them, Tuff, thousands. The waters churned madly, and they rose, all those vast black shadows coming up at us, as far as the eye could see, in all directions. We attacked them with lasers, with explosive shells, with everything we had. It was like the sky itself was ablaze. All those things were bulging with hydrogen, and the air was rich and giddy with the oxygen they had vented. The fire dawn, as we call it. It was terrible. Screaming everywhere, balloons burning, our airships crushed and falling around us, bodies of fire. There were dreadnoughts waiting below, too. I saw them snatching swimmers who had fallen from the airships, those pale tentacles coiling around them and yanking them under. Four skimmers escaped from that battle. Four. Every airship was lost, with all hands.
A grim tale, said Tuff.
Kafira Kay had a haunted look in her eyes. She was petting foolishness with a blind rhythm. Her lips pressed tightly together, her eyes fixed on the screen, where the first fire balloon floated above the tumbling corpse of the spirit of Aquarius. Since then, she said at last, life has been a continuing nightmare. We have lost our seas. On 3/4 of Namur, hunger and even starvation hold sway. Only New Atlantis still has surplus food, since only there is land farming practiced extensively. The Guardians have continued to fight. The Sunraiser and our other two spacecraft have been pressed into service bombing runs, dumping poison, evacuating some of the smaller islands. With air cars and fast skimmers, we have maintained a loose web of contact with the outer islands, and we have radio, of course, but we are barely hanging on. Within the last year, more than 20 islands have fallen silent. We sent patrols out to investigate in 6 of those cases. Those that returned all reported the same thing. Bodies everywhere, rotting in the sun. Buildings crushed and ruined, scrabblers and crawling maggies feasting on the corpses. And on one island they found something else, something even more frightful. The island was Sea Star. Almost 40,000 people lived there, and it was a major spaceport as well, before trade was cut off. It was a terrible shock when Sea Star suddenly stopped broadcasting. Go to the next exhibit, Tuff. Go on. Tuff pressed a series of lights on the console. A dead thing was lying on a beach, rotting on indigo sands. It was a still picture, this one, not a tape. Haviland Tuff and Guardian Kafira Kay had a long time to study the dead thing, where it sprawled, rich and rotten. Around and about it was a litter of human corpses, lending its scale by their proximity. The dead thing was shaped like an inverted bowl, and it was as big as a house. Its leathery flesh, cracked and oozing pustulence now, was a mottled grey-green. Spread on the sand around it, like spokes from a central wheel, were the thing's appendages. 10 twisted green tentacles, puckered with pinkish-white mouths, and alternately 10 limbs that looked stiff and hard and black and were obviously jointed. Legs, said Kafira Kay bitterly. It was a walker, Tuff, before they killed it. We have only found that one specimen, but it was enough. We know why our islands fall silent now.
They come from out of the sea, Tuff. Things like that. Larger, smaller, walking on 10 legs like spiders, and grabbing and eating with the other 10, the tentacles. The carapace is thick and tough. A single explosive shell or laser burst won't kill one of these the way it would a fire balloon, so now you understand. First the sea, then the air, and now it has begun on the land as well. The land! They burst from the water in thousands, striding up into the sand like some terrible tide. 2 islands were overrun last week alone. They mean to wipe us from this planet. No doubt a few of us will survive on New Atlantis, in the high inland mountains, but it will be a cruel life, and a short one, until Namor throws something new at us, some new thing out of nightmare. Her voice had a wild edge of hysteria. Havilland Tuff turned off his console, and the telescreens all went black.
"Calm yourself, Guardian," he said, turning to face her. "Your fears are understandable, but unnecessary. I appreciate your plight more fully now. A tragic one indeed, yet not hopeless."
"You still think you can help?" she said. "Alone? You and the ship? Oh, I'm not discouraging you by any means. We'll grasp at any straw. But..."
"But you do not believe," Tuff said.
A small sigh escaped his lips.
"Shh! Doubt," he said to the grey kitten, hoisting him up in a huge white hand. "You are indeed well named."
He shifted his gaze back to Kafira Kay.
"I am a forgiving man, and you have been through many cruel hardships, so I shall take no notice of the casual way you belittle me and my abilities. Now, if you might excuse me, I have work to do. Your people have sent up a great many more detailed reports on these creatures, and on Namorian ecology in general. It is vital that I peruse these in order to understand and analyze the situation. Thank you for your briefing."
Kafira Kay frowned, lifted foolishness from her knee, and set him on the ground and stood up. "Very well," she said. "How soon will you be ready?"
"I cannot ascertain that with any degree of accuracy," Tuff replied. "Until I have had a chance to run some simulations, perhaps a day and we shall begin, perhaps a month, perhaps longer."
"If you take too long, you'll find it difficult to collect your 2 million, she snapped. "We'll all be dead."
"Indeed," said Tuff. "I shall strive to avoid that scenario. Now, if you would let me work, we shall converse again at dinner. I shall serve vegetable stew in the fashion of Aryan, with plates of Thorite fire mushrooms to whet our appetites."
Kay sighed loudly. "Oh, mushrooms again," she complained. "We had stir-fried mushrooms and peppers for lunch, and crisped mushrooms in bitter cream for breakfast."
"I am fond of mushrooms," said Havilland Tuff.
"I am weary of mushrooms," said Kafira Kay. Foolishness rubbed up against her leg, and she frowned down at him. "Might I suggest some meat or seafood?" She looked wistful. "It's been years since I had a mud pot. I dream of it sometimes. Crack it open and pour butter inside and spoon out the soft meat. Oh, you can't imagine how fine it was. Or sabre fin. Oh, I'd kill for a sabre fin on a bed of seagrass." Havilland Tuff looked stern.
"We do not eat animals here," he said.
He set to work ignoring her, and Kafira Kay took her leave. Foolishness went bounding after her.
"Appropriate," muttered Tuff. "Indeed."
4 days and many mushrooms later, Kafira Kay began to pressure Havilland Tuff for results. "What are you doing?" she demanded over dinner. "When are you going to act? Every day you seclude yourself, and every day conditions on Namor worsen. I spoke to Lord Guardian Harvin, an hour ago, while you were off with your computers. Little Aquarius and the Dancing Sisters have been lost, while you and I are up here dithering, Tuff.
Dithering? Said Haviland Tuff. Guardian, I do not dither. I have never dithered, nor do I intend to begin dithering now. I work. There's a great mass of information to digest.
Kephira Kay snorted. A great mass of mushrooms to digest, you mean? She said. She stood up, tipping foolishness from her lap. The kitten and she had become boon companions of late. 12,000 people lived on Little Aquarius, she said, and almost as many on the Dancing Sisters. Think of that, while you're digesting, Tuff. She spun and stalked out of the room.
Indeed, said Haviland Tuff.
He returned his attention to his sweet flower pie. A week passed before they clashed again. Well, the guardian demanded one day in the corridor, stepping in front of Tuff, as he lumbered with great dignity down to his workroom.
Well, he repeated. Good day, Guardian K.
It is not a good day, she said querulously. Namor Control tells me the Sunrise Islands are gone, overrun, and a dozen skimmers lost defending them, along with all the ships drawn up in those harbours. What do you say to that?
Oh, most tragic, replied Tuff. Regrettable.
When are you going to be ready? He gave a great shrug.
Oh, I cannot say. This is no simple task you have set me. A most complex problem. Complex, yes, indeed. That is the very word. Perhaps I might even say mystifying. I assure you that Namor's sad plight has fully engaged my sympathies, however, and this problem has similarly engaged my intellect.
That's all it is to you. Tuff, isn't it? A problem. Haviland Tuff frowned slightly and folded his hands before him, resting them atop his bulging stomach.
A problem indeed, he said.
No, this is not just a problem. This is no game we are playing. Real people are dying down there, dying because the guardians are not equal to their trust, and because you do nothing, nothing.
Calm yourself. You have my assurance that I am laboring ceaselessly on your behalf. You must consider that my task is not so simple as yours. It's all very well and good to drop bombs on a dreadnought or fire shells into a fire balloon and watch it burn. Yet these simple, quaint methods have availed you little, Guardian. Ecological engineering is a far more demanding business. I study the reports of your leaders, your marine biologists, your historians. I reflect and analyze. I devise various approaches and run simulations on the Ark's great computers. Sooner or later, I shall find your answer.
Sooner, said Kephira Kay in a hard voice. Namor wants results, and I agree. The Council of Guardians is impatient. Sooner, Tuff, not later, I warn you. She stepped aside and let him pass. Kephira Kay spent the next week and a half avoiding Tuff as much as possible. She skipped dinner and scowled when she saw him in the corridors. Each day she repaired to the communications room, where she had long discussions with her superiors below, and kept up on all the latest news. It was bad. All the news was bad. Finally, things came to a head. Pale-faced and furious, she stalked into the darkened chamber Tuff called his war room, where she found him sitting before a bank of computer screens watching red and blue lines chase each other across a grid. Tuff! She roared. He turned off the screen and swung to face her, batting away ingratitude. Shrouded by shadows, he regarded her impassively. The Council of Guardians has given me an order, she said.
Oh, how fortunate for you, Tuff replied. I know you have been growing restless of late from inactivity.
The Council wants immediate action, Tuff. Immediate. Today. Do you understand? Tuff steepled his hands beneath his chin, almost in an attitude of prayer.
must I tolerate not only hostility and impatience, but slurs on my intelligence as well? I understand all that needs understanding about your guardians, I assure you. It is only the peculiar and perverse ecology of Namor that I do not understand. Until I have acquired that understanding, I cannot act.
You will act, said Kefira Kay. Suddenly a laser pistol was in her hand, aimed at Tuff's broad paunch. You will act now. Haviland Tuff reacted not at all.
Violence, he said, in a tone of mild reproach. Perhaps before you burn a hole in me and thereby doom yourself and your world, you might give me the opportunity to explain.
Go on, she said. I'll listen. For a little while.
Excellent, said Haviland Tuff. Guardian, something very odd is happening on Namor.
Oh, you've noticed, she said dryly. The laser did not move.
Indeed, you are being destroyed by an infestation of creatures that we must, for want of a better term, collectively dub sea monsters. Three species have appeared in less than half a dozen standard years. Each of these species is apparently new, or at least unknown. This strikes me as unlikely in the extreme. Your people have been on Namor for 100 years, yet not until recently have you had any knowledge of these things you call dreadnoughts, fire balloons, and walkers. It is almost as if some dark analogue of my Ark were waging bio-war upon you. Yet obviously that is not the case. New or old, these sea monsters are native to Namor, a product of local evolution. Their close relatives fill your seas, the mudpots, the bobbing Freddies, the jelly dancers and men of war. So, where does that leave us?
I don't know, said Kefira Kay.
Nor do I, Tuff said. Consider further. These sea monsters breed in vast numbers. The sea teems with them. They fill the air, they overrun populous islands, they kill. Yet they do not kill each other, nor do they seem to have any other natural enemies. The cruel checks of a normal ecosystem do not apply. I have studied the reports of your scientists with great interest. Much about these sea monsters is fascinating, but perhaps most intriguing is the fact that you know nothing about them, except in their full adult form. Vast dreadnoughts prowl the seas and sink ships. Monstrous fire balloons swirl across your skies. Where, might I ask, are the little dreadnoughts, the baby balloons? Where indeed?
Deep under the sea.
Perhaps, Guardian, perhaps. You cannot say for certain, nor can I. These monsters are most formidable creatures, yet I have seen equally formidable predators on other worlds. They do not number in hundreds or thousands. Why? Ah, because the young, or the eggs, or the hatchlings. They are less formidable than the parents, and most die long before reaching their terrible maturity. This does not appear to happen on Namor. It does not appear to happen at all. What can it all mean? What, indeed?
Tuff shrugged.
I cannot say, but I work on. I think. I endeavor to solve the riddle of your overabundant sea.
Kefira Kay grimaced. And meanwhile, we die. We die, and you don't care.
Oh, I protest,
Tuff began. Silence, she said, waving the laser. I'll talk now. You've given your speech. Today we lost contact with a broken hand. 43 islands, Tuff. I'm afraid to even think how many people. All gone now in a single day. A few garbled radio transmissions, hysteria, and silence. And you sit and talk about riddles? No more. You will take action now, I insist. Or threaten, if you prefer.
Later we will solve the whys and hows of these things. For the moment, we will kill them, without pausing for questions.
Once, said Haviland Tuff, there was a world idyllic but for a single flaw. An insect, the size of a dust mote. It was a harmless creature, but it was everywhere. It fed on the microscopic spores of floating fungus. The folk of this world hated the tiny insect, which sometimes flew about in clouds so thick they obscured the sun. When citizens went outdoors, the insects would land on them by the thousands, covering their bodies with a living shroud. So a would-be ecological engineer proposed to solve their problem. From a distant world, he introduced another insect, larger, to prey on the living dust motes. The scheme worked admirably. The new insects multiplied and multiplied, having no natural enemies in this ecosystem, until they had entirely wiped out the native species. It was a great triumph. Unfortunately, there were unforeseen side effects. The invader, having destroyed one form of life, moved on to other, more beneficial sorts. Many native insects became extinct. The local analogue of bird life, deprived of its customary prey and unable to digest the alien bug, also suffered grievously. Plants were not pollinated as before. Whole forests and jungles changed and withered. And the spores of the fungus that had been the food of the original nuisance were left unchecked. The fungus grew everywhere, on buildings, on food crops, even on living animals, and in short, the ecosystem was wrenched entirely askew. Today, should you visit, you would find a planet dead, but for a terrible fungus. Such are the fruits of hasty action, with insufficient study. There are grave risks should one move without understanding.
And certain destruction if one fails to move at all, Gafira Kay said stubbornly. No, Tuff, you tell frightening tales, but we are a desperate people. The Guardians accept whatever risk there may be. I have my orders. Unless you do as I bid, I will use this. She nodded at her laser.
Haviland Tuff folded his arms. If you use that, he said, you will be very foolish. No doubt you could learn to operate the Ark in time. The task would take years, which by your own admission you do not have. I shall work on in your behalf, and forgive you your crude bluster and your threats, but I shall move only when I deem myself ready. I am an ecological engineer. I have my personal and professional integrity. And I must point out that without my services, you are utterly without hope. Utterly. So, since you know this, and I know this, let us dispense with further drama. You will not use that laser.
For a moment, Kafira Kay's face looked stricken. You, she said in confusion. The laser wavered just a bit. Then her look hardened once again. You're wrong, Tuff, she said. I will use it. Haviland Tuff said nothing. Not on you, she said. On your cats. I will kill one of them every day until you take action. Her wrist moved slightly, so the laser was trained not on Tuff, but on the small form of Ingratitude, who was prowling hither and yon about the room, poking at shadows. I will start with this one, the Guardian said. On the count of three. Tuff's face was utterly without emotion. He stared. One, said Kafira Kay. Tuff sat immobile. Two, she said. Tuff frowned, and there were wrinkles in his chalk-white brow. Three, Kay blurted.
No, Tuff said quickly. Do not fire. I shall do as you insist. I can begin cloning within the hour. The Guardian holstered her laser.
So Haviland Tuff went reluctantly to war. On the first day he sat in his war room before his great consul, tight-lipped and quiet, turning dials and pressing glowing buttons and phantom holographic keys. Elsewhere on the Ark, murky liquids of many shades and colours spilled and gurgled into the empty vats along the shadowy main shaft, while specimens from the great cell library were shifted and sprayed and manipulated by tiny Waldos as sensitive as the hands of a master surgeon. Tuff saw none of it. He remained at his post, starting one clone after another. On the second day, he did the same. On the third day, he rose and strolled slowly down the kilometers-long shaft where his creations had begun to grow, indistinct forms that stirred feebly, or not at all, in the tanks of translucent liquid. Some tanks were fully as large as the Ark's shuttle deck, others as small as a fingernail. Haviland Tuff paused by each, studied the dials and meters and glowing spyscopes with a quiet intensity, and sometimes made small adjustments. By the end of the day he had progressed only half the length of the long, echoing row. On the fourth day he completed his rounds. On the fifth day he threw in the chronowarp.
"Time is its slave," he told Kaphira Kay when she asked him. "It can hold it slow, or bid it hurry. We shall make it run, so the warriors I breed can reach maturity more quickly than in nature."
On the sixth day he busied himself on the shuttle deck, modifying two of his shuttles to carry the creatures he was fashioning, adding tanks great and small, and filling them with water. On the morning of the seventh day he joined Kaphira Kay for breakfast and said,
"Guardian, we are ready to begin."
She was surprised. "So soon?"
"Not all of my beasts have reached full maturity, but that is as it should be. Some are monstrous large and must be transshipped before they have attained adult growth. The cloning shall continue, of course. We must establish our creatures in sufficient numbers so they will remain viable. Nonetheless, we're now at the stage where it is possible to begin seeding the seeds of Namor."
"What is your strategy?" asked Kaphira Kay. Haviland Tuff pushed aside his plate and pursed his lips.
"Such strategy as I have is crude and premature, Guardian, and based on insufficient knowledge. I take no responsibility for its success or failure. Your cruel threats have impelled me to unseemly haste."
"Nonetheless," she snapped, "what are you doing?" Tuff folded his hands atop his stomach.
"Biological weaponry, like other sorts of armament, comes in many forms and sizes. The best way to slay a human enemy is a single laser burst planted square in the center of the forehead. In biological terms, the analog might be a suitable natural enemy or predator, or a species-specific pestilence. Lacking time, I've had no opportunity to devise such an economical solution. Other approaches are less satisfactory. I might introduce a disease that would cleanse your world of dreadnoughts, fire balloons and walkers, for example. Several likely candidates exist, yet your sea monsters are close relatives of many other kinds of marine life, and those cousins and uncles would also suffer. My projections indicate that fully three-quarters of Namor's ocean-going life would be vulnerable to such an attack. Alternatively, I have at my disposal fast-breeding fungi and microscopic animals who would literally fill your seas and crowd out all other life. That choice, too, is unsatisfactory. Ultimately, it would make Namor incapable of sustaining human life. To pursue my analogy of a moment ago, these methods are the biological equivalent of killing a single human enemy by exploding a low-yield thermonuclear device in the city in which he happens to reside. So, I have ruled them out. Instead, I have opted for what might be termed a scattershot strategy, introducing many new species into your Nemorian ecology in the hopes that some of them will prove effective natural enemies capable of winnowing the ranks of your sea monsters. Some of my warriors are great deadly beasts, formidable enough to prey even on your terrible dreadnoughts. Others are small and fleet, semi-social pack hunters who breed quickly. Still others are tiny things. I have hope they will find and feed on your nightmare creatures in their younger, less potent stages, and thereby thin them out. So you see, I pursue many strategies. I toss down the entire deck rather than playing a single card. Given your bitter ultimatum, it is the only way to proceed. Tuff nodded at her. I trust you will be satisfied, Guardian Kay. She frowned and said nothing. If you are finished with that delightful sweet mushroom porridge, Tuff said, we might begin. I would not have you think that I was dragging my feet. You are a trained pilot, of course.
Yes, she snapped.
Excellent, Tuff exclaimed. I shall instruct you in the peculiar idiosyncrasies of my shuttlecraft, then. By this hour, they are already fully stocked for our first run. We shall make long, low runs across your seas and discharge our cargoes into your troubled waters. I shall fly the Basilisk above your northern hemisphere. You shall take the Manticore to the south. If the plan is acceptable, let us go over the routes I have planned for us.
He rose with great dignity. For the next 20 days, Haviland Tuff and Kaphira Kay crisscrossed the dangerous skies of Namor in a painstaking grid pattern seeding the seas. The Guardian flew her runs with Elan. It felt good to be in action again, and she was filled with hope as well. The dreadnoughts and fire balloons and walkers would have their own nightmares to contend with now, nightmares from 50 scattered worlds. From old Poseidon came vampire eels and nessies and floating tangles of webweed, transparent and razor-sharp and deadly. From Aquarius, Tuff cloned black raveners, the swifter scarlet raveners, poisonous puff puppies, and fragrant carnivorous lady's bane. From Jameson's world, the vats summoned sand dragons and drearhants, and a dozen kinds of brightly coloured water snakes, large and small. From old Earth itself, the cell library provided great white sharks, barracuda, giant squid, and clever semi-sentient orcas. They seeded Namor with the monstrous grey kraken of Lysidor and the smaller blue kraken of ants, with water jelly colonies from Noborn, Duronian spinnerwhips and bloodlace out of Cathedae, with swimmers as large as the fortress fish of Damtolion, the muck whale of Gulliver, and the grinder of Runtu, or as small as the blister fins of Avalon, the parasitical Kesni from Menander, and the deadly nest-building, egg-laying Deirdran water wasps. To hunt the drifting fire balloons, they brought forth countless flyers, lash-tail mantas, bright red razor wings, flocks of scorn, semi-aquatic howlers, and a terrible pale-blue thing, half-plant and half-animal and all but weightless, that drifted with the wind and lurked inside clouds like a living, hungry spiderweb. Tuff called it the weed that weeps and whispers and advised Kaphira Kay not to fly through clouds. Plants and animals and things that were both and neither. Predators and parasites. Creatures dark as night, or bright and gorgeous, or entirely colourless. Things strange and beautiful beyond words, or too hideous even for thought. From worlds whose names burn bright in human history, and from others seldom heard of. And more, day after day, the Basilisk
and the Manticore flashed above the seas of Namor, too swift and deadly for the fire balloons that drifted up to attack them, dropping their living weapons with impunity. After each day's run, they would repair to the Ark, where Havlin Tuff and one or more of his cats would seek solitude, while Kefirake habitually took foolishness with her to the communications room so she could listen to the reports. Guardian Smith reports the sighting of strange creatures in the Orange Strait. No sign of dreadnoughts. A dreadnought has been seen off Bathurn, locked in terrible combat with some huge tentacle thing twice its size. A grey kraken, you say. Very well, we shall have to learn these names, Guardian K. Mulador Strand reports that a family of lashtail mantas have taken up residence on the offshore rocks. Guardian Horn says they slice through fire balloons like living knives, that the balloons flail and deflate and fall helplessly. Wonderful. Today we have heard from Indigo Beach, Guardian K, a strange story. Three walkers came rushing out of the water, but it was no attack. They were crazed, staggering about as if in great pain, and ropes of some pale, scummy substance dangled from every joint and gap. What is it? A dead dreadnought washed up on New Atlantis today. Another corpse was sighted by the Sunraiser on its western patrol, rotting atop the water. Various strange fishes were picking it to pieces. Starsword swung out to far heights yesterday and sighted less than half a dozen fire balloons. The Council of Guardians is thinking of resuming short airship flights to the Modpot Pearls on a trial basis. What do you think, Guardian K? Would you advise that we risk it, or is it premature? Each day the reports flooded in, and each day Kefira K smiled more broadly as she made her runs in the Manticore. But Havlin Tuff remained silent and impassive. 34 days into the war, Lord Guardian Lyson told her, "Well, another dead dreadnought was found today. It must have put up quite a battle. Our scientists have been analysing the contents of its stomachs, and it appears to have fed exclusively on orca and blue kraken." Kefira K frowned slightly, then shrugged it off. "A grey kraken washed up on Boreen today," Lord Guardian Mohan told her a few days later. "The residents are complaining of the stink. It has gigantic round bite marks, they report. Obviously a dreadnought, but even larger than the usual kind." Guardian Key shifted uncomfortably. "All the sharks seem to have vanished from the Amber Sea. The biologists can't account for it. What do you think? Ask Tuff about it, will you?" She listened and felt a faint trickle of alarm. "Here's a strange one for you two. Something has been sighted moving back and forth across the Coherent Deep. We've had reports from both Sunraiser and Skynarf and various confirmations from skimmer patrols. A huge thing, they say, a veritable living island sweeping up everything in its path. Is that one of yours? If it is, you may have miscalculated. They say it's eating barracuda and blisterfin and larder's needles by the thousands." Kefira K scowled.
"Fire balloons sighted again off Mulador Strand, hundreds of them. I can hardly give credence to these reports, but they say the lashtail mentors just carom off them now. Do you—" "Men of war again, can you believe it? We thought they were all nearly gone. So many of them, and they're gobbling up tough smaller fish like nobody's business. You have to—" "Dreadnoughts spraying water to knock howlers from the sky."
"Something new, Kefira, a flyer, or a glider rather. Swarms of them launch from the tops of these fire balloons. They've gotten three skimmers already, and the mantas are no match for them. All over, I tell you. That thing that hides in the clouds, the balloons just rip them loose. The acid doesn't bother them any more. They fling them down. More dead water wasps, hundreds of them, thousands. Where are they all—"
"Walkers again. Castle Dawn has fallen silent, must be overrun. We can't understand it.
The island was ringed by blood lace and water jelly colonies. It ought to have been safe, unless... No word from Indigo Beach in a week. 30 or 40 fire balloons just seen off cabin. The council fears...
Nothing from Labadoon. Dead fortress fish, half as big as the island itself.
Dreadnought came right into the harbour.
Walkers.
Guardian Key, the Star Sword is lost. Gone down over the polar sea. The last transmission was garbled, but we think...
Kefira Kay pushed herself up, trembling, and turned to rush out of the communications room, where all the screens were babbling news of death, destruction, defeat. Haviland Tuff was standing behind her, his pale white face impassive, Ingratitude sitting calmly on his broad left shoulder.
"What is happening?"
the Guardian demanded.
"I should think that would be obvious, Guardian, to any person of normal intelligence. We are losing. Perhaps we have lost already."
Kefira Kay fought to keep from shrieking.
"Aren't you going to do anything? Fight back? This is all your fault, Tuff. You aren't an ecological engineer. You're a traitor who doesn't know what he's doing. That's why this is..."
Haviland Tuff raised up a hand for silence.
"Please," he said. "You have already caused me considerable vexation. Insult me no further. I am a gentleman of kindly and benevolent disposition, but even one such as myself can be provoked to anger. You press close to that point now. Guardian, I take no responsibility for this unfortunate course of events. This hasty bio-war we have waged was none of my idea. Your uncivilized ultimatum forced me to unwise action in order to placate you. Fortunately, while you have spent your nights gloating over transient and illusory victories, I have continued with my work. I have mapped out your world on my computers, and watch the course of your war shudder and flow across it in all its manifold stages. I've duplicated your biosphere in one of my great tanks, and seeded it with samples of Nemorian life, cloned from dead specimens, a bit of tentacle here, a piece of carapace there. I have observed and analyzed, and at last I have come to conclusions. Tentative, to be sure, although this late sequence of events on Namor tends to confirm my hypothesis. So defame me no further, Guardian. After a refreshing night's sleep, I shall descend to Namor and attempt to end this war of yours."
Kefira Kay stared at him, hardly daring to believe, her dread turning to hope once again.
"You have the answer, then?"
"Indeed. Did I not just say as much?"
"What is it?"
she demanded.
"Some new creatures? That's it. You've cloned something else, haven't you? Some plague, some monster."
Haviland Tuff held up his hand.
"Patience. First, I must be certain. You have mocked me and derided me with such unflagging vigor that I hesitate to open myself to further ridicule by confiding my plans to you. I shall prove them valid first. Now, let us discuss tomorrow. You shall fly no war runs with the Manticore. Instead, I will have you take it to New Atlantis and convene a full meeting of the Council of Guardians. Fetch those who require fetching from outlying islands, please."
"And you?" Kefira Kay asked.
"I shall meet with the Council when it is time. Prior to that, I shall take my plans and my creature to Namor on a mission of my own. We shall descend in the Phoenix, I believe. Yes, I do believe the Phoenix most appropriate, to commemorate your world rising from its ashes. Markedly wet ashes, but ashes nonetheless."
Kefira Kay met Haviland Tuff on the shuttle deck just prior to their scheduled departure. Manticore and Phoenix stood ready in their launch berths amid the scatter of derelict spacecraft.
Havlintuff Tuff was punching numbers into a mini-computer strapped to the inside of his wrist. He wore a long grey vinyl grey coat with copious pockets and flaring shoulder boards. A green and brown duck-billed cap decorated with a golden theta of the ecological engineers perched rakishly atop his bald head. "I have notified Namor Control and Guardian Headquarters," Kay said. "The Council is assembling. I will provide transportation for half a dozen Lords Guardian from outlying districts, so all of them will be on hand. How about you, Tuft? Are you ready? Is your mystery creature on board?"
"Soon," said Havlintuff, blinking at her.
But Kaphira Kay was not looking at his face. Her gaze had gone lower. "Tuff," she said, "there is something in your pocket, moving." Incredulous, she watched the ripple creep along beneath the vinyl.
"Ah," said Tuff, "indeed."
And then the head emerged from his pocket and peered around curiously. It belonged to a kitten, a tiny jet-black kitten with lambent yellow eyes. "A cat," muttered Kaphira Kay sourly.
"Your perception is uncanny," said Havlintuff.
He lifted the kitten out gently and held it cupped in one great white hand while scratching behind its ear with a finger from the other.
"This is Dax," he said solemnly.
Dax was scarcely half the size of the older kittens who frisked about the ark. He looked like nothing but a ball of black fur, curiously limp and indolent. "Wonderful," the Guardian replied. "Dax, eh? Where did this one come from? No, don't answer that. I can guess. Tuff, don't we have more important things to do than play with cats?"
"I think not," said Havlintuff. "You do not appreciate cats sufficiently, Guardian. They are the most civilized of creatures. No world can be considered truly cultured without cats. Are you aware that all cats from time immemorial have had a touch of psi? Do you know that some ancient societies of old Earth worship cats as gods? It is true."
"Please," said Kaphira Kay, irritably, "we don't have time for a discourse on cats. Are you going to bring that poor little thing down to Namor with you?"
Tuff blinked. "Indeed, this poor little thing, as you so contemptuously call him, is the salvation of Namor. Respect might be in order."
She stared at him as if he'd gone mad.
"What? That? Him? I mean, Dax? Are you serious? What are you talking about? You're joking, aren't you? This is some kind of insane jest. You got some thing loaded aboard the Phoenix, some huge leviathan, that will cleanse the sea of those dreadnoughts. Something, anything, I don't know, but you can't mean, you can't, not that."
"Him," said Havlintuff. "Guardian, it is so wearisome to state the obvious. Not once, but again and again, I have given you raveners and krakens and lashtail manters at your insistence. They have not been efficacious. Accordingly, I have done much hard thinking, and I have cloned Dax."
"A kitten," she said. "You are going to use a kitten against the dreadnoughts and the farbloons and the walkers? One small kitten?"
"Indeed," said Havlintuff.
He frowned down at her, slid Dax back into the roomier confines of his great pocket, and turned smartly toward the waiting Phoenix. Kaphira Kay was growing very nervous. In the council chambers, high atop Breakwater Tower on New Atlantis, the 25 Lords Guardian who commanded the defense of all Namor were restive. All of them had been waiting for hours. Some had been there all day. The long conference table was littered with personal communicators and computer printouts and empty water glasses. Two meals had already been served and cleared away. By the wide, curving window that dominated the far wall, portly Lord Guardian Alice was talking in low, urgent tones to Lord Guardian Lyson, thin and stern, and both of them were giving meaningful glances to Kaphira Kay from time to time. Behind them, the sun was going down,
and the great bay was turning a lovely shade of scarlet. It was such a beautiful scene that one scarcely noticed the small bright dots that were guardian skimmers flying patrol. Dusk was almost upon them. The council members were grumbling and stirring impatiently in their big cushioned chairs, and Haviland Tuff had still failed to make an appearance.
"When did he say he would be here?"
asked Lord Guardian Kem for the fifth time.
"He wasn't very precise, Lord Guardian," Kefira Kay replied uneasily for the fifth time.
Kem frowned and cleared his throat. Then one of the communicators began to beep, and Lord Guardian Lyson strode over briskly and snatched it up.
"Yes," he said. "I see. Quite good. Escort him in."
He set down the communicator and rapped its edge on the table for order. The others shuffled to their seats, or broke off their conversations, or straightened. The council chamber grew silent.
"That was the patrol. Tuff's shuttle has been sighted. He's on his way, I'm pleased to report."
Lyson glanced at Kefira Kay.
"At last."
The Guardian felt even more uneasy then. It was bad enough that Tuff had kept them waiting, but she was dreading the moment when he came lumbering in, Dax peering out of his pocket. Kay had been unable to find the words to tell her superiors that Tuff proposed to save Namor with a small black kitten. She fidgeted in her seat and plucked at her large, crooked nose. This was going to be bad, she feared. It was worse than anything she could have dreamed. All the Lord's Guardian were waiting, stiff and silent and attentive, when the doors opened and Haviland Tuff walked in, escorted by four armed guards in golden coveralls. He was a mess. His boots made a squishing sound as he walked, and his greatcoat was smeared with mud. Dax was visible in his left pocket, all right, paws hooked over its edge and large eyes intent. But the Lord's Guardian weren't looking at the kitten. Beneath his other arm, Haviland Tuff was carrying a muddy rock the size of a big man's head. A thick coating of green-brown slime covered it, and it was dripping water onto the plush carpet. Without so much as a word, Tuff went directly to the conference table and set the rock down in the center of it. That was when Kefira Kay saw the fringe of tentacles, pale and fine as threads, and realized that this wasn't a rock after all. "A mud pot," she said, aloud in surprise. No wonder she hadn't recognized it. She had seen many a mud pot in her time, but not until after they had been washed and boiled and the tendrils trimmed away. Normally they were served with a hammer and chisel to crack the bony carapace and a dish of melted butter and spices on the side. The Lord's Guardian looked on in astonishment, and then all 25 began talking at once, and the council chamber became a blur of overlapping voices.
"It is a mud pot. I don't understand. What is the meaning of this?"
"He makes his way all day and then comes to council as filthy as a mud grubber. The dignity of the council is...
Haven't eaten a mud pot in, oh, 2 or 3? Can't be the man who's supposed to save. Insane. Why, just look at...
What is that thing in his pocket? Look at it, my God, it moved. It's alive, I tell you. I saw it."
"Silence!"
Lyson's voice was like a knife cutting through the hubbub. The room quieted as one by one the Lord's Guardian turned toward him.
"We have come together at your beck and call," Lyson said acidly to Tuff. "We expect you to bring us an answer. Instead, your pair to have brought us dinner."
Someone snickered. Haviland Tuff frowned down at his muddy hands and wiped them primly on his greatcoat. Taking Dax from his pocket, Tuff deposited the lethargic black kitten on the table. Dax yawned and stretched, and ambled towards the nearest of the Lord's Guardian, who stared in horror and hurriedly inched her chair back a bit. Shrugging out of his wet, muddy greatcoat, Tuff looked about for a place to put it, and finally hung it from the laser rifle of one of his escort. Only then did he turn back to the Lord's Guardian.
"Esteemed Lord's Guardian," he said, "this is not a dinner you see before you. In that very attitude lies the root of all your problems. This is the ambassador of the race that shares Namor with you, whose name, regrettably, is far beyond my small capabilities. His people will take it quite badly if you eat him.
Eventually, someone brought Lysander a gavel, and he rapped it long and loud enough to attract everyone's attention, and the furore slowly ebbed away. Havlan Tuff had stood impassively through all of it, his face without expression, his arms folded against his chest. Only when silence was restored did he say,
"Perhaps I should explain."
"You are mad,"
Lord Guardian Harvin said, looking from Tuft to the mud pot and back again.
"Utterly mad."
Havlan Tuff scooped up Dax from the table, cradled him in one arm, and began to pet him.
"Even in our moment of victory, we are mocked and insulted," he said to the kitten.
"Tuff," said Lyson from the head of the long table, "what you suggest is impossible. We have explored Namor quite sufficiently in the century we have been here, so as to be certain that no sentient races dwell upon it. There are no cities, no roads, no signs of any prior civilization or technology, no ruins or artifacts, nothing, neither above nor below the sea.
Moreover," said another counselor, a beefy woman with a red face,
"the mudpots cannot possibly be sentient. Agreed, they have brains the size of a human brain, but that is about all they have. They have no eyes, ears, noses, almost no sensory equipment whatever, except for touch. They have only those feeble tendrils as manipulative organs, scarcely strong enough to lift a pebble. And in fact, the tendrils are only used to anchor them to their spot on the seabed. They are hermaphroditic and downright primitive, mobile only in the first month of life, before the shell hardens and grows heavy. Once they root on the bottom and cover themselves with mud, they never move again. They stay there for hundreds of years."
"Thousands," said Havlan Tuff. "They are remarkably long-lived creatures. All that you say is undoubtedly correct. Nonetheless, your conclusions are in error. You have allowed yourself to be blinded by belligerence and fear. If you had removed yourself from the situation and paused long enough to think about it in depth, as I did, no doubt it would become obvious even to the military mind that your plight was no natural catastrophe. Only the machinations of some enemy intelligence could sufficiently explain the tragic course of events on Namor."
"You don't expect us to believe," someone began.
"Sir," said Havlan Tuff, "I expect you to listen. If you will refrain from interrupting me, I will explain all. Then you may choose to believe or not, as suits your peculiar fancy. I shall take my fee and depart."
Tuff looked at Dax.
"Idiots, Dax. Everywhere we are beset by idiots."
Turning his attention back to Lord's Guardian, he continued,
"As I have stated, intelligence was clearly at work here. The difficulty was in finding that intelligence. I perused the work of your Namorian biologists, living and dead, read much about your flora and fauna, recreated many of the native life forms aboard the Ark. No likely candidate for sentience was immediately forthcoming. The traditional hallmarks of intelligent life include a large brain, sophisticated biological sensors, mobility, and some sort of manipulative organ, such as an opposable thumb. Nowhere on Namor could I find a creature with all of these attributes. My hypothesis, however, was still correct. Therefore, I must needs move on to unlikely candidates, as there were no likely ones. To this end, I studied the history of your plight, and at once some things suggest to themselves. You believe that your sea monsters emerge from the dark oceanic depths. But where do they first appear? In the offshore shallows, the areas where you practiced fishing and sea farming. What did all these areas have in common? Certainly an abundance of life, that must be admitted, yet not the same life. The fish that habituated the waters off New Atlantis did not frequent those of the Broken Hand. Yet I found two interesting exceptions. Two species found virtually everywhere. The mudpots. Lying immobile in their great soft beds through the long, slow centuries, and originally the things you call Nemorian men of war. The ancient native race has another term for those. They call them guardians. Once I had come this far, it was only a matter of working out the details and confirming my suspicions. I might have arrived at my conclusion much earlier, but for the rude interruptions of Liaison Officer K, who continually shattered my concentration and finally, most cruelly, forced me to waste much time sending forth grey krakens and razor wings and sundry other such creatures. In the future, I shall spare myself such liaisons. Yet, in a way, the experiment was useful, since it confirmed my theory as to the true situation on Namor. Accordingly, I pressed on. Geographic studies showed that all of the monsters were thickest near mudpot beds. The heaviest fighting had been in those selfsame areas, my lord's guardian. Clearly, these mudpots you find so eminently edible were your mysterious foes. Yet how could that be? These creatures had large brains, to be sure, but lacked all the other traits we have come to associate with sentience as we know it. And that was the very heart of it. Clearly they were sentient as we do not know it. What sort of intelligent being could live deep under the sea, immobile, blind, deaf, bereft of all input? I pondered that question. The answer, sirs, is obvious. Such an intelligence must interact with the world in ways we cannot, must have its own modes of sensing and communicating. Such an intelligence must be telepathic. Indeed, the more I considered it, the more obvious it became. Thereupon, it was only a matter of testing my conclusions. To that end, I brought forth Dax. All cats have some small psionic ability, Lord's Guardian. Yet long centuries ago, in the days of the Great War, the soldiers of the Federal Empire struggled against enemies with terrible psi powers. Herengan minds and Githyanki soul sucks. To combat such formidable foes, the genetic engineers worked with felines and vastly heightened and sharpened their psionic abilities, so they could ESP in unison with mere humans. Dax is such a special animal.
You mean that thing is reading our minds? Lyson said sharply.
Insofar as you have minds to read, said Havlin Tuff. Yes, but more importantly, through Dax, I was able to reach the ancient people you have so ignominiously dubbed mudpots. For they, you see, are entirely telepathic. For millennia beyond counting, they have dwelt in tranquility and peace beneath the seas of this world. They are a slow, thoughtful, philosophical race, and they live side by side in the billions, each linked with all the others, each an individual, and each a part of a great racial whole. In a sense, they were deathless, for all shared the experiences of each, and the death of one was as nothing. Experiences were few in the unchanging sea, however. For the most part, their long lives are given over to abstract thought, to philosophy, to strange green dreams that neither you nor I can truly comprehend. They are silent musicians, one might say. Together, they have woven great symphonies of dreams, and those songs go on and on. Before humanity came to Namor, they had had no real enemies for millions of years. Yet that had not always been the case. In the primordial beginnings of this wet world, the oceans teemed with creatures who relished the taste of the dreamers as much as you do. Even then, the race understood genetics, understood evolution. With their vast web of interwoven minds, they were able to manipulate the very stuff of life itself, more skillfully than any genetic engineers. And so they evolved their guardians, formidable predators with biological imperative to protect those you call mudpots. These were your men of war. From that time to this, they guarded the beds while the dreamers went back to their symphony of thought. Then you came from Aquarius and old Poseidon. Indeed you did. Lost in the reverie, the dreamers hardly noticed for many years, while you farmed and fished and discovered the taste of mud pots. You must consider the shock you gave them, Lord's Guardian. Each time you plunged one of them into boiling water, all of them shared the sensations. To the dreamers, it seemed as though some terrible new predator had evolved upon the landmass, a place of little interest to them. They had no inkling that you might be sentient, since they could no more conceive of a non-telepathic sentience than you could conceive of one blind, deaf, immobile, and edible. To them, things that moved and manipulated and ate flesh were animals and could be nothing else. The rest you know or can surmise. The dreamers are a slow people, lost in their vast songs, and they were slow to respond. First, they simply ignored you, in the belief that the ecosystem itself would shortly check your ravages. This did not appear to happen. To them it seemed you had no natural enemies. You bred and expanded constantly, and many thousands of minds fell silent. Finally, they returned to the ancient, almost forgotten ways of the dim past, and woke to protect themselves. They sped up the reproduction of their guardians until the seas above their beds teemed with their protectors. But the creatures that had once sufficed admirably against other enemies proved to be no match for you. Finally, they were driven to new measures. Their minds broke off the great symphony and ranged out, and they sensed and understood. At last they began to fashion new guardians, guardians formidable enough to protect them against this great new nemesis. Thus it went. When I arrived upon the Ark, and Kafira Kay forced me to unleash many new threats to their peaceful dominion, the dreamers were initially taken aback. But the struggle had sharpened them, and they responded more quickly now, and in only a very short time they were dreaming newer guardians still, and sending them forth to battle to oppose the creatures I had loosed upon them. Even as I speak to you in this most imposing tower of yours, many a new terrible life form is stirring beneath the waves and soon will emerge to trouble your sleep in years to come. Unless, of course, you come to a peace. That is entirely your decision. I am only a humble ecological engineer. I would not dream of dictating such matters to the likes of you. Yet I do suggest it in the strongest possible terms. So here is the ambassador plucked from the sea, at great personal discomfort to myself, I might add. The dreamers are now in much turmoil, for when they felt Dax among them, and through him touch me, their world increased a millionfold. They learned of the stars today, and learn, moreover, that they are not alone in this cosmos. I believe they will be reasonable, as they have no use for the land, nor any taste for fish. Here is Dax as well, and myself. Perhaps we might commence to talk.
But when Havlintuff fell silent at last, no one spoke for quite a long time. The Lord's Guardian were all ashen and numb. One by one, they looked away from Tuff's impassive features to the muddy shell on the table. Finally, Kaffira Kay found her voice.
"What do they want?"
she asked nervously.
"Chiefly," said Havlintuff, "they want you to stop eating them. This strikes me as an eminently sensible proposal. What is your reply?" 2 million standards is insufficient,"
Havlintuff said sometime later, sitting in the communications room of the Ark. Dax rested calmly in his lap, having little of the frenetic energy of the other kittens. Elsewhere in the room, suspicion and hostility were chasing each other hither and yon. Up on the telescreen, Kaffira Kay's features broke into a suspicious scowl.
"What do you mean? This was the price we agreed upon, Tuff. If you're trying to cheat us..."
"Cheat?" Tuff sighed. "Oh, did you hear her, Dax? After all we have done, such grim accusations are still flung at us, willy-nilly. Yes, willy-nilly indeed. An odd phrase when one stops to mull on it."
He looked back at the telescreen.
"Guardian K, I am fully aware of the agreed-on price. For 2 million standards, I solved your difficulties. I analyzed and pondered and provided the insight and the translator you so sorely needed. I've even left you with 25 telepathic cats, each linked to one of your Lord's Guardian, to facilitate further communications after my departure. That, too, is included within the terms of our initial agreement, since it was necessary to the solution of your problem, and being at heart more a philanthropist than a businessman, and deeply sentimental as well, I've even allowed you to retain Foolishness, who took a liking to you for some reason that I am entirely unable to fathom. For that, too, there is no charge."
"Then why are you demanding an additional 3 million standards?"
demanded Kaffira Kay.
"For unnecessary work which I was cruelly compelled to do," Tuff replied. "Would you care for an itemized accounting?"
"Yes, I would," she said.
"Very well. For sharks, for barracuda, for giant squid, for orcas, for grey kraken, for blue kraken, for blood lace, for water jellies, 20,000 standards per item. For fortress fish, 50,000 standards. For the weed that weeps and whispers, 8.
He went on for a long, long time. When he was done, Kaffira Kay set her lips sternly.
"I will submit your bill to the Council of Guardians," she said, "but I will tell you straight out that your demands are unfair and exorbitant, and our balance of trade is not sufficient to allow for such an outflow of hard standards. You can wait in orbit for 100 years, Tuff, but you won't get any 5 million standards."
Havlintuff raised his hands in surrender.
"Ah," he said, "so because of my trusting nature, I must take a loss. I will not be paid, then."
2 million standards," said the Guardian, "as we agreed."
"I suppose I might accept this cruel and unethical decision and take it as one of life's hard lessons. Very well, then, so be it."
He stroked Dax.
"It has been said that those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it. I can only blame myself for this wretched turn of events. Why, it was only a few scant months past that I chanced to view a historical drama on this very sort of situation. It was about a siege ship, such as my own, that rid one small world of an annoying pest, only to have the ungrateful planetary government refuse payment. Had I been wiser, that would have taught me to demand my payment in advance. He sighed. But I was not wise, and now I must suffer. Tuff stroked Dax again and paused. Perhaps your Council of Guardians might be interested in viewing this particular tape, purely for recreational purposes. It is holographic, fully dramatized and well-acted, and moreover, it gives a fascinating insight into the workings and capabilities of a ship such as this one, highly educational. The title is Seed Ship of Hamelin.
They paid him, of course.